Good evening. This is James McCanny going right into the show, September 13th, 2007. And a ton of topics to cover tonight. Just a second, I have to adjust something on my system here. And okay, back live. The first topic I want to talk about is has to do with standards in science. And by the way, the main topic for the show tonight is dealing with a term I coined back in the late 1970s. It's called the electric universe. And what does that really mean? And what does it mean to you? What are some of the implications of that term? And I'll read a phrase out of one of my published papers back then dealing with that term and the popularization of that term as I worked through the 1980s as I was a faculty member at Cornell. And I'm going to go back and forth in time on this show, up into the future, some of the issues that are going on today, and then back in time to some of my own work and to some of the work of other authors, some of it that goes back to the ancient days, some of our ancestors, what we call the dawn of civilization. So that would be the main topic for tonight. But I first want to begin talking about standards. Standards in journalism, radio, publication. And standards today are taking a severe beating because of basically unethical standards of authors, of other forms of media that put this out to the public. And as the public, you have to be somewhat aware of this. And with the internet today, it's kind of like the Old West. It's whoever can draw the fastest and get something out there. And so we have a lot of issues dealing with poor standards, very bad standards that should be in place, and there should be watchdogs. And I just want to give a quick example of a good standard. When I was on a talk show host recently, a friend of mine out of Illinois, James Jancic, was interviewing me, in fact, about tonight's topic, Electric Universe. And there's some people on the internet who are trying to borrow that term and use it for profit and to pretend that they are somehow authors, scientists, etc. And the very common thing with these imposters that you find on the internet is they all have kind of a common thread. They claim to have degrees, which they don't have. They claim to have associations, which they don't have. A lot of times they make associations with dead people because, gee, they're not alive to defray this kind of misuse of their name, on and on. So a whole list of scams that are being used by these imposters. But at any rate, I was on a show with James Jancic interviewing me regarding my Electric Universe work, and specifically weather and the core of the sun and the fusion in the high atmosphere of the sun, some very somewhat esoteric topics. But in the middle of the interview, he mentioned that he had personally sent emails and communications to the people who are obviously attempting to copy my work, and said, gee, you know, he said he did it in a friendly manner, not confrontational, and in a professional manner. Said, gee, what you're doing looks an awful like what Professor McCanny is doing. And after establishing somewhat of a conversation with him to get the email conversation going, and as with thousands of other people who have done the same thing with these imposters, he never heard back. Now, this is where he did his, what we call, due diligence. He made an effort as a talk show host to find out what was really going on here. And he did it for himself. He found out for himself. And that's what we call due diligence. It's a term you use whether you're managing a city, whether you're a librarian, whether you're an editor of a journal, or whether you're a talk show host. When something's brought to your attention, you should follow up. And unfortunately, there's too many times today when these standards are not being met. They're being slid, they're being let slide. And I'm going to go through a couple topics here. Now, I've done a whole series of shows on disinformation and standards, and that was at the end of December in 2005. So I'm not going to repeat that. I'm just going to go into a few of the issues that are occurring today on the internet, and this is important because there's a whole wave of new disinformation books coming out, and they are going to be placed in front of you, and you, the unwary public, is going to be watching these stuck in your face, and they will be on the internet. They'll be possibly on certain talk shows where they try and popularize these. And so you have to be smart about this, and they're going to fool some people. There's no doubt about it, and that's what they're intended to do. They're intended to fool as much of the public as they can. So at any rate, I want to first talk about standards and where these standards came from. When I was educated, I took a course called Ethics. And in the Ethics course, which, by the way, many colleges don't teach anymore, Harvard University Law School dropped their Ethics course, unfortunately, and now we have a good number of educated people, supposedly, with no ethics or understanding of ethics or standards. Now, let's talk about one standard in journalism, something called plagiarism. Pretending you're an author when you're not. Pretending that you have a degree when you're not. Writing a paper and pretending it's your own work and not including the references to a person who has written and studied that particular topic. And one of the greatest forms of plagiarism in existence today is the last one. The lack of referencing or proper referencing of people who have come before and done the work. So these are subtle things, and there are all kinds of excuses you hear, like, oh, well, I only referenced things that came earlier, or I referenced this person over here, but selective referencing is literally plagiarism. And so, I want to mention that as one. Phony degrees. People claiming that they have degrees. There was just a guy coming out with a book in August who claimed to have an honorary PhD or doctorate. You don't really call it a PhD because a PhD is literally a form of a grade that you earn by actually attending classes. The term doctor is somewhat a loose reference to that. And in our society, we look at, for example, chiropractors. We call them a doctor. Or a dentist, we'll call them a doctor, but after their name, they have a very specific designation that comes to them from an accredited university or institution where the institution is accredited. So here now we have a guy that's popping up trying to reproduce my material, claim he's the author, not referencing me, and then claiming to be a doctor. And when you research the doctor that he claims, it's from a foreign country, from an unaccredited institution, and this is the way honorary degrees work. If you have a PhD, a doctor, a true doctor's degree from an accredited university, and you get a honorary degree, which is common in this country and internationally, then you call yourself doctor because of the original degree that you earned. If you do not have a degree, if you do not have a PhD from an accredited university, and some institution bestows a honorary doctor on you, you still don't call yourself doctor because you have not earned a PhD. You can't put that PhD designation after your name. And you are not a doctor. The other point is, if you get your honorary doctor's designation from an unaccredited agency, by all standards, you cannot call yourself a doctor. So this is the kind of thing I want to put out there. And so the public, sometimes they hear, oh, this person is a plasma physicist from Australia. And you think you're quite impressed, but when you follow up with these people, they don't have any degree at all. Now, how do you become a plasma physicist without ever having taken any physics courses, let alone advanced physics courses. Now, I want to tell you that for my own part, I've earned a master's degree in physics, in solid state and nuclear physics, and I'm very proud of that because I worked very hard and I had to get my Bachelor of Science degree, Bachelor of Arts degree, actually, in physics, and it's a double major, physics and mathematics, and I worked very hard for that. So when somebody comes along and claims to be a doctor, when they're not, claims to be the author of a material, which they are not, and talk show hosts put these people on the air and pretend and don't do their due diligence, even when they've been notified, we have a problem. We have a credibility problem. And as for myself, I cannot personally associate myself with people who do not do that due diligence and who will not require standards of their guests. It's as simple as that. Then you add in the disinformation crew that's floating around the internet. These are government-sponsored people who run around and actually sponsor a lot of disinformation that's floating around the internet, around talk show hosts. And one of the most subtle forms of disinformation is giving part of the story that sounds credible, but then taking a 90-degree turn and actually throwing out disinformation. So you use a title like Planet X or the Mayan Calendar or 2012 or the Coburn Bible or ancient texts, on and on. You use these as a draw because you know that that's going to get somebody's attention. And then the disinformation specialists, some of them have PhDs in disinformation, will actually take that message and then do a 90-degree turn, and actually that's when the disinformation comes out. One of the biggest forms of disinformation is the omission of information. So at any rate, these are some buzzwords that I want you to remember. Jot them down and put a big disinfo on capital letters on top of these. 2012, the Mayan calendar. They're taking topics which are legitimate topics, the Coburn Bible, the ancient texts regarding the Exodus, and on. Planet X is a term that's an astronomical term which has been made crazy because people claim to talk to extraterrestrials that tell them when an object is going to come into the solar system and devastate our Earth. Now, these are very serious topics, and for people to very whimsically put out misinformation to the public is really a form of very bad scholarship, and these people should be identified and publicly denounced. And that's exactly, now I've spent a good deal of time on my radio shows around the year 2003. Remember the May 15th, 2003, some woman claimed that extraterrestrials talked to her and said that a giant planet would come and destroy us on May 15, 2003. And I spent a good deal of time on my radio show every week because they were actually producing pictures on web pages. And what we found out is, guess who? NASA, none other than our illustrious, highly paid space agency, was providing the pictures. And the way we found out was I analyzed the pictures, and they had very short exposure times on deep space objects. And you could tell this by a number of techniques of analyzing pictures. So I determined, even though they said these pictures were taken by an amateur with a 14-inch backyard telescope, it was very clear to me that these pictures that they were posting on the internet were taken by professionals with large telescopes, professional telescopes. And so you have to ask yourself, why are people taking this topic of Planet X and trying to make it crazy, trying to divert it? I have my books out, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, Surviving Planet X Passage, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and on, my weather book, Principia Meteorologia. These are all written for the public so that you understand the true issues of the electrical nature of the universe, how they work. And what's going on right now is there's a whole laundry list of imposter, wannabe, imitation authors coming out with very deceptive titles. And so I'm not going to advertise, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this show diverting those wannabe authors. All I'm going to say is there are some shows out there, and word's going to get around fairly quick which ones they are, which are promoting imposters, wannabes, and people who are not doctors or PhDs who are pretending to be. They are, and then when you go to one of their websites, you get linked to some of the other websites. So it's a train of disinformation that's being propagated. Here's an example. Now, the other night on a radio show, somebody was claiming to be the author that most people that listened to it, I didn't myself, but they said that, gee, it just sounded like Jim McCanney talking. And this is, unfortunately, a new reality in some radio shows. But then you get to the disinformation, and they have what appear to be planted questions, people calling in, asking questions, and somebody calls in and goes, well, gee, what should we do as a civilization? And you know what the answer was? We should all get together with Mexico, Central America, Canada, and the United States and form the North American Union. Gee, now, what does this have to do with surviving Planet X? Well, you can see that these are government-sponsored people, and the message is, this is what I'm talking about. They grab a topic, and that's the disinformation. That's the message that they want to send to people coming out of your new supposed alleged doctor or whatever. And they sound amazingly like people like myself who are trying to bring you real information. Plagiarism, phony degrees, honorary degrees that have no basis, unverifiable information, information that sounds deceptively similar to other real authors like Velikovsky or the Colburn Bible, which was an ancient text, myself, etc., on and on. And so at any rate, that's all I'm going to say about that. And just keep your eye out. You're going to see a lot of this in the upcoming weeks. And a good friend of mine, his name is John Moore. He's a talk show host. I'm a guest there frequently. And his read on this also from his inside information is this entire business about 2012 is a ruse. And remember that the May 15, 2003 date was early. In fact, nothing happened. And the whole idea was to make everybody think that Planet X was a nutty topic, only talked about by people that thought aliens talked to them, and that it didn't happen, and therefore don't think about it anymore. Well, gee, isn't it amazing that all of a sudden we have a new crop of people coming up who are doing the same thing? They're claiming that extraterrestrials talk to them, and that the extraterrestrials have told them that Planet X is coming in 2012, and that somehow the Mayan calendar predicts this. Well, let me tell you something. I've studied the Mayan calendars and a great deal about the Mayans in general, and the Mayan calendar in no way, shape, or form predicts the end of the world in 2012. Nor can you project that calendar back in time, thousands of years, as people are attempting to do. And these are people who have no credibility. They are not known in the industry. That's another one of the ways you tell. And I have friends who work in black ops. They know people that are in black ops. They know the people to ask. And when somebody makes a claim that they have been, say, working on some secret government program, doesn't take long to find out that that's a ruse also. So at any rate, on to the next topic. I'm just telling you this because I want you to be aware that there's going to be more and more disinformation, and I personally won't associate myself with people who do not do their due diligence and remain and keep standards. And I don't buy the argument, well, this is just entertainment. I'm sorry, if you're talking about something coming into the solar system that's going to destroy the entire planet, That's more than entertainment, and you best do your due diligence and find out if these references are credible if you're trying to put it on the airwaves or out in front of the public on the internet or whatever medium you happen to choose. There are a lot of people who don't have real backgrounds and to understand this, and I'll tell you, when you get into these topics, you better know what you're talking about, because there are 1,000 different small areas that reach back into ancient history and reach into the distant future. And when you get somebody on that really has not done the research, they're only copying from someone else, you soon recognize it because they start repeating themselves. They are like Johnny One Notes, so to speak. But at any rate, just be aware that there's going to be a lot of phonies out there coming at you, and using the 2012 Mayan calendar, Planet X, extraterrestrials, trying to refer to ancient texts, etc. Okay, on to the next topic. October issue of Popular Science. Now, I'm referring to this because there's an article in there dealing with Europe's tourist rocket, it calls it. And I want to read this because they specifically slam private entrepreneurs. They're talking in this article about a company called Astrium, division of the European Aeronautical Defense and Space Company, which is the second largest aerospace corporation in the world, second only to Boeing of the United States. And now, about a month ago, a guy named Bert Rutan was working with a company they called Virgin Galactic, and they had a little accident out in the desert, the Mojave Desert, near their research lab. And for 25 years, Rutan has had a spotless record on his experimental aircraft and on his developments up until this point, where 4 people were killed in an explosion. And I said, when this first happened, I said to myself, this sounds like sabotage, because these large aerospace corporations are, this is their bread and butter. And if a small startup company can use relatively insignificant amount of private funding and go into space, where does that leave the large government-funded aerospace corporations? And these corporations make billions and billions through the CEOs, get extremely rich, the marketing and et cetera. These are extremely profitable corporations at the government dole. So it's not in their best interest to see someone like Rutan using private money and going into space and beating them. So anyway, what's funny about your Astrium rocket design is it's exactly what I was talking about on my show April 14th, 2005. And about a year or 6 months after my show, where I described this exact launch vehicle, it looks like a Learjet, and you basically carry an oxygenated fuel when you get above the denser part of the atmosphere. You take off from a runway and you land on a runway. And it's a new concept. It's for suborbital flight. And I talked about this in great detail on my April 14th, 2005 show. And I've talked about this on many other shows also. But interestingly enough, a corporation called Rocket Plane, shortly after my radio show, started cutting up a Learjet to try and make such an aircraft. Well, now, 2007, September, this company out of Europe happens to pick up the same design. Exactly what I was talking about on my radio show. And for all the same reasons. It's a runway to low Earth orbit suborbital flight vehicle. And I gave all of the orbital dynamics and aerospace airframe data, basically showing why this was a good idea. And I want to reiterate my opinion on the Rutan explosion, which killed 4 people. Scaled Composites is the rutan company. My opinion that I would put a 99.999% probability that the explosion was sabotage and directly related to the large science aerospace corporations who saw this as a threat to their payroll from the government dole. So at any rate, but I want you to just listen to the description that is written in popular science. Here's a quote. Your ride to space may not come from a scrappy startup after all. And then they go on to talk about the European large corporation. Let me see, a scrappy startup. We're talking about Virgin Galactic, which is a company with an impeccable record. We're talking about Rutan, which is a 25-year-old company with an impeccable record, hardly what I'd call a scrappy startup. In the introduction in the table of contents, here's how they introduce this same article. Page 40, Europe's tourist rocket. Watch out, Virgin Galactic, and all you other space plane renegades. Space plane renegades is how they describe Rutan and the other startups who are attempting to use private funding to do what the big aerospace corporations are just beginning to do. Now, I remember a time when mammoth mainframe computers were the mainstay of the day. And IBM was a company that refused to accept the concept of the personal computer. And only after other companies had developed it and it became a marketing success did IBM come in, put a tremendous amount of marketing into it, the personal computer, and now we typically call personal computers PCs or IBM compatible. Isn't that interesting? Even though IBM refused to go into this industry in the very beginning, and they were able to, with money, muscle their way and throw out the small contenders and become IBM compatible. The same thing is going to happen in the aerospace industry, and this is what I've talked about before. A quick diversion, who runs our colleges and universities today? This is a very serious question. Who runs our schools? Who runs the publishing houses that provide textbooks? And it's very scary to see what's happened in the last few years where universities and colleges have a new kind of a lot of people have come in from outside and are now putting new standards. You look at the result of the Virginia Tech shooting that occurred, a year and a half ago or whatever. And now we have surveillance on campus, cameras at every turn, IDs that allow you in and out of doors. And this is all to protect the students. Isn't that handy? But the other thing it does is it also keeps track of students. It can keep track of what they're talking about. And this is just another example of, the standard term is Big Brother. And the way you typically get Big Brother in, if people don't like it, is you cause an incident. So that brings up the question, was the Virginia Tech shooting a staged operation to gain control of universities and college campuses? The Mexicans this past week have been blowing up pipelines, natural gas, oil pipelines. And this is to shut down American factories in Mexico because they're paying substandard wages. This is going to, I'm just going to briefly mention that because it's going to lead into a topic that I'm going to talk about in just a minute, what I call a crisis in the auto industry where critical parts, I've already seen this, when the cars go for their federal testing, they have parts made, their first run parts, the critical parts in the automobile. But when the mass production automobile is made, you don't know who is making the parts, where they're being made. And the one thing you can bet on is there's probably no quality control. Anyway, I'll talk about that in just a minute. But a very happy time in science, 30 years since the Voyager spacecraft left planet Earth. September 5th, 1977, these were launched, and I remember well when these were launched. 2 years later, the first Voyager arrived at Jupiter, and about a year later, arriving at Saturn, 1980. And I personally was at Cornell University at that time as an introductory faculty member, seeing the data come in for the first time. And what was amazing was to see that the theoretical work that I had been developing, the electric universe concepts, were being verified as this data came in on a daily basis. And tonight, in honor of that 30-year anniversary, I want to tell you how the information is transmitted from these ancient spacecraft back to Earth and how we transmit information to those spacecraft. Basically, on the spacecraft, there's a piece of electronics called a Marconi oscillator. It's an electrical design due to our good friend Marconi, who had quite a few developments along with Tesla back in the early radio days. But it's a tuned oscillator. Now, when I was a undergraduate student getting my bachelor's degree in physics, my senior project dealt with a kind of an esoteric topic called Auger electrons. And to measure these electrons in the experiment, we needed a very low-level signal. We had to detect this very low-level signal outside of the vacuum chamber where the equipment was installed. And to do this, we used basically the equivalent of two Marconi oscillators. One was in the equipment and one was outside. You transmit the data at a very special frequency. Now, in space, in the laboratory, or just about any place in our environment, there's a lot of electrical noise. So the question is, how do you get that faint signal from a little spacecraft at the end of the solar system and detect it and measure it and get the data out of that very weak signal? And the way you do it is you have two tuned oscillators. The one on the spacecraft is tuned to the exact same frequency as the one on the ground. And so when you're transmitting on that frequency, and the receiving antenna on the spacecraft is tuned to that, and the electronics at the end of that antenna are tuned to that exact same frequency. All of the other noise at all the other frequencies is simply filtered out, and you do not see any of that. The only thing you see is that one frequency that you're looking for. So at any rate, that's how they transmit and receive data from those little spacecraft that were launched in 1977 with what we would consider extremely primitive equipment, electronics, radio equipment, and they're still transmitting and receiving data 30 years later. So as I've always said in the space program, my hat off to the engineers, the scientists behind the scene. Not the ones with their name in neon lights, not the Carl Sagans, but the engineers that you've never heard their name that design this equipment, maintain it, and operate it, and make these amazing satellites do what they do in outer space. So that's just one indication, and the tremendous data that came back from those Voyagers. Unfortunately, a lot of that data being misinterpreted and misguided by the scientists who ultimately got the data and ultimately had no idea and still have no idea what it really meant. Quick note on the number of scams coming out of global warming. Now, everybody is in favor of stopping pollution, but it turns out that global warming is really due to the variable output of the sun. It has very little to do with you driving your SUV around or burning up oil. One of the points is we should not be polluting this planet, but unfortunately the global warming scenario is only focusing on CO2 emissions, all of the rest of the pollution being going by the board unnoticed. And so isn't global warming a great thing for the polluters? Because they're polluting and polluting, and everybody's got their eye on CO2. So anyway, here's a quick laundry list of scams that are occurring due to the cover of global warming. The industry wants to reduce their costs, and they're going to blame it on global warming, so salaries will be coming down, and they're going to convince the public, or at least try to, that you got to take a pay cut due to global warming. How about green industries? Every industry is trying to figure out how they can be green, what they can do to try and sell you a product at a higher price and put the green label on it. So everybody's going green, trying to look like they're environmentally friendly, and they're going to charge you double or triple. Just like the old organic label where they're going to sell you products sometimes grown in human feces that in fact are labeled organic, and you're paying two or three times the value of regular fruit, bananas or whatever, vegetables. Control of water. Droughts and floods and unusual weather are going to be blamed every time on global warming. So the control of water, and I've talked about this many times before, is going to be blamed on global warming. When in fact we have a huge amount of water, it's just improperly managed. And once again, international meetings, scientists, politicians trying to resolve what they call protocols, putting the dates out so far in the future that they're absolutely ridiculous and meaningless, and no one has to do anything until the year 2030 or whatever they resolve. And as I said, pollution, real pollution, is never mentioned. Pollution on the rise in the world. There is a lake in Pretoria, Africa, that is so polluted that there are warnings that it is dangerous to your health to drink the water. And they've tested the animals and aquatic life around this area, finding that, in fact, cancer is rampant in the animals around this reservoir. And oddly enough, when the scientists attempted to publish their results, the government panels refused to let them publish the names of the reservoirs where the pollution is highest. At any rate, just a quick mention, the Berkey water filter. I'm going to spend about 30 seconds, so listen. If you have your pen handy, write this down. My webpage, jmccsci.com. That's J-M-C-C, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. The Berkey water filter, if you don't have one, I believe you're crazy. $315 is the best deal on the planet. What you get is the Big Berkey 2.25-gallon water filter. It's a simply two stainless steel containers, one on top of the other. There's no electric connections. There is no pressure. There's no hoses. Just simply pour the water in the top, and you have two filter elements that you can use. You get two extra filter elements with this that you will need in case of an emergency. Plus, I give the free Kato WRX 911 shortwave radio that you can use to listen to this show and a lot of other radio shows on shortwave AM and FM, and free shipping to the 50 states for $315. Many people, I have found out, are taking these as they travel, even in the United States today. And the mail order address is quickly JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. Once again, that's $315 to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. And very interesting topic relative to water this past week. In past weeks, I've talked about where is Lake Superior water going. And interestingly enough, a major article released this past week that the California vegetable growers, farmers, large-scale farmers, have been moving to northern Mexico. Well, that brings up the question, if Mexico didn't have water to raise those kind of crops 6 or 8 years ago, where are they getting the water? Could it be Lake Superior? I think we have found out where the Lake Superior water is going. Now the question is to follow the trail, so to speak, and I've got a number of data points, verifiable places where a 3-foot water pipeline has been placed on the way down to Mexico from Minnesota. And we will be researching that and reporting on that in the near future. So stay tuned. Quickly, the crisis in the auto industry, I predict, is going to come up. Critical part failures. I've heard stories, just nightmare stories, of people's engines falling out of cars, dropping down on the steering mechanism in the bottom of the car. And it brings up the question that once the cars are being mass manufactured, where are the parts being produced, the critical parts? Where's the quality control? And, you know, this is going to be an especially, now I've seen this also in the construction industry, where parts like light fixtures or light switches, other critical parts that could burn your house down if they're not properly made or if they break while they're in use, you will find now it's hard to screw light bulbs into light sockets, and you look and you find that there's very poor quality control on the tolerances. Bolts, I had a personal experience with bolt heads where one or some of the bolt heads would fit into a socket set and other ones of the exact same lot would not fit into the socket head. So we're going to see more of this as greedy American businessmen try and move their businesses offshore to save a buck. And one last quick item. The Italians this week were on strike because food is now being processed into ethanol at such a rate that the price of food is skyrocketing, especially for the Italians, the pasta that they eat. So at any rate, this is something that I talked about a long time ago. We're actually seeing it now. Just a quick mention, tropical storm number 8 in the Atlantic Ocean, as of tonight, just sitting there, not forming. This past week, the solar wind, that wind of charged particles coming off the sun, almost came to a dead stop. And this is typical of the August return current sheet that's blowing back towards the sun as the Earth passes through this region in the month of August. The solar wind coming almost to a dead stop. So the storms, you saw that Umberto, the storm that just went into the Galveston area, really didn't have much of a tropical storm other than a lot of water. It had a lot of water damage, but not a tremendous amount of wind for this time of year. And the same with Tropical Storm 8 that is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean right now. Also, just not picking up any steam, and the main meteorological prediction centers just can't figure out why Tropical Storm 8 is not forming. Well, it's very clear there's no electrical energy coming into the planet right now to keep that storm moving. Okay, on to the main science topic, electric universe. And I'm just going to grab my book here. And hope I can find this page quickly. It's in the page 50. Here it is. Now, this is a paper that was published originally in 1979 and then republished in a peer-reviewed journal called Kronos in the early 1980s. And I'm talking about, in this particular section, the state of the scientific community. I'm actually making a summary of the very extensive 3-part paper, about 70 pages total, with hundreds of references. And here's what I said. Here's how I conclude this paper, the part 3, the third part of an extensive 3-part paper on comets, solar system formation, and the electrical conditions in the solar system from 1979. Here's the quote from page 50, and if you have the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, you can find it. It's about 6 pages from the end, page 50 of this paper. It says, "Has data and observation pointed towards an electrical universe. And that is the term I use to summarize. That's the one term which literally summarizes my work dealing with everything from the subatomic world up to the macro world to the cosmological scale. And within that framework, what I did was I, first of all, had to dispel a lot of myth and bad science produced by standard astronomy and astrophysics community who thought that space had to be electrically neutral. Now, let's go back to the 1970s and the state of thought, what we called Chapman physics at the time. And you have to understand, for me to actually do what I did, I had to also study standard physics. I knew it better than most of the scientists who called themselves traditional astrophysics and space science professors and the astronomers. I had to study and know more about their field than they did. Then I had to take and alter that, including electrodynamics, to produce the theoretical work and the changes to that that I had to produce to understand how the solar system worked. And so let's talk about the state of thought of electromagnetism in the solar system. And it was believed that there could not be any electrical charges in outer space. And this is a standard physics problem that was performed by every grad student that went through grad school in those years. Here's how it would work. If you put a charge in outer space, where you have the plasma environment, you have free charge, positive charge, negative charge, just floating around, free to move, no resistance, and you all of a sudden magically could put a big charge out in the middle of that, all of a sudden, within seconds, possibly milliseconds or even microseconds, all the charge that was in the vicinity would of the opposite polarity would come racing in and neutralize that charge. And then the rest of the charge would form a shield around it, and so as a visible charge with any properties of charge, it was neutralized instantaneously, almost as fast as the blink of an eye. So with this understanding and the theoretical problems that every grad student had to perform, the physics problems, they were convinced that there could not possibly be electric charges in outer space. And I did these same problems. I worked through them. But one thing I understood was that if you had a vast charge separating engine in the center, in the center of all of this, called the sun, then you had an entirely different scenario. And this is what, when I first started studying comets, and I understood that comets had to be electrically charged, that they drew the tail material into the comet nucleus. It was not melting away. I realized that the comet nucleus had an extensive sunward electrical spike, and I had to produce the energy, the source of electric field, where all of this process stemmed from. What was the source of energy? And so it finally came to light. As the Voyager data was coming in, I confirmed that my suspicions were correct, that there was an excess positive current. There were more protons in the solar wind than electrons. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, the electrons happen to be remaining near the sun in what we call the corona. It's a shield of electrons that surrounds the sun, and by all standard theoretical means, scientists still have not figured out how that corona can sit there with just gravity alone at work. But they kind of ignore that little problem, but I did not. I didn't leave any rock unturned. I didn't leave any of these anomalies unexplained. And so what I realized is the energy from the galaxy, the energy of the solar system, the electrical energy that influences our weather, that influences the X-rays that we see on Venus, that influences the bands and the hurricanes that we see on Jupiter. All of this was a result of fusion in the high reaches of the solar atmosphere, separating charge, and that was the original source of the separation of charge, the battery of the solar system, and then it blasted this excess current of positive charge out of the sun. It went out too far beyond the farthest planet and formed a giant capacitor. Some of that current came back into the sun, and that's what I call the August return current sheet. Now, that's a basic fundamental view of the solar system. Now, as a planet or a comet or anything in the solar system, a dust grain, as it moves through this electric field, it's going to discharge it. And the example I started using back then, being from Minnesota, a state where the mosquito is the state bird, there was a thing called the zapper or the mosquito killer or bug killer, and it worked exactly like the solar system. So I started using that as an example. Now, when the bug flies between the two electrically charged grids, he's flying towards the neon light in the center, but he unwittingly goes between the two electrical plates. And where do the plates discharge? Right along the path of the bug. It does it every time. And you can hear that zap noise and then watch the bug fall down dead. He just got zapped by a pretty good electrical discharge. And that's what the planets are doing. That's what Jupiter, Saturn, Earth, Venus, Mercury, every comet in the solar system, every asteroid in the solar system, and every grain of dust in the solar system is doing the same thing. They are all electrically charged because they are discharging the solar capacitor. With this information in mind, I learned that the galaxy does the same thing. In the center of the galaxy is a huge fusion engine driving the same type of proton wind, and therefore there's a current that flows back down the galactic arm of which we are a member, our sun and our solar system is a member, and that electrical current is something we interact with as we move through outer space, our entire solar system. Excuse me. So, to understand the electric universe is to understand what causes that. Now, back in the 1800s, there were people who observed electrical effects. Tesla was able to tap into that and actually derive energy from our ionosphere and drive it onto a grid system to power basically houses and lights, etc. He was able to power a car because he knew how to tap into the vertical electric field of Earth. So there were many scientists who observed auroras, that Birkeland, those scientists observed these, but they did not know what caused the electrical universe that they were observing. When I was in the mid-1990s working with Russian scientists, the reason they picked up my work and translated it into Russian was because it explained their observations of electrical phenomenon in the atmosphere of Earth. They knew that weather could not be explained by solar energy input. You cannot explain the energy of a hurricane due to solar light or warm water from an ocean. And they knew that. It's a very simple energy calculation to prove that these storms, tornadoes, hurricanes, cyclones, waterspouts, typhoons, none of these can be explained with standard energy arguments from a gravitational-only Earth. And so they took my work and translated that material regarding the electric universe as it explained the energy source that drove these tremendous storms, our weather, our wind patterns, our jet streams in the atmosphere. All of these were explained electrically, and you could not explain any of these without the electrical explanation. Thus, every place we turn, the system that we're looking at is driven from electrical forces. Trees, plants, all have a vertical electric field, which helps them live. Without the vertical electric field, plants would die. They couldn't exist. We would not have clouds without a vertical electric field. That vertical electric field is a result of the sun's electric field, and it has very little to do with the light coming in to Earth. So at any rate, I just wanted to give a brief synopsis of the term electrical universe. Where did that term come from? It's the term I coined when I was first working with this material and bringing it to the public in the late 1970s. And that term remained. Now there are people attempting to borrow that term, imitation imposter scientists, and you're going to see this on the internet. You're going to see the people, but when you spend a little time trying to analyze where they come from, you'll see they are imposters. I want to make a mention here. Now, I'm a scientist. I bring my information directly to the public on this radio show, but I also work diligently within the scientific community. And I don't talk about this a lot in public because I've learned that what happens is the imposters then try and take the references to real scientists that I put out and try and abuse them. And these scientists really are excellent scientists, and they do a very good job. And so I don't give out the names of my associations on the air for that very reason. But I want to assure you that I go to the scientific meetings, and literally every scientific meeting in the world today is posing the questions that are listed in my books regarding the energy systems for storms, for the what they call sprites and elves. These are electrical discharges that occur above thunderstorms. There's research being done right here in Minnesota at one of our local universities. It's one of the top research centers for observing lightning bolts, very energetic lightning bolts. Now, we consider usually lightning coming out of the bottom of a cloud and striking Earth. But a number of years ago, they discovered that the lightning actually goes up out of the cloud, out of the top of the cloud at the same time. And where is that energy coming from? Ultimately from the sun, but in our local case, it's coming from the ionosphere, that cloud of ions that circle the Earth about 60 to 200 miles above the Earth's surface. Tremendous amount of energy contained there. And when the storm clouds reach up, they start to discharge this capacitor. That's what powers hurricanes. And in the case of Tropical Depression number 8, which is out in the Atlantic Ocean right now, we do not have enough energy in the atmosphere at this time to drive that storm. So it's just sitting there, and standard meteorology doesn't know why. I watched the Weather Channel today, as the meteorologist stood there with somewhat of a befuddled look on her face, trying to explain why this hurricane just wasn't getting going, because you got plenty of warm water out there. And if it's hurricanes are formed by warm water, then why is this hurricane not forming? Why is it just sitting there idle? The real reason, because there's no electrical energy in the planetary capacitor at this time to drive that storm, to create it, to maintain it. So at any rate, I just wanted to give a little brief history on the term electrical universe. Where did it come from? What does it mean? And the last point is, we are all electrically connected to this planet. Our psyches, our minds, our cycles, and we also can feel the movement, the electrical movement of the other planets. Once again, this is Jim McCanny. I am out of time. This is my science hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.